Hello, welcome to this week's Football Fans Podcast with myself, your host, Jordan Jarrett Brown. And on the podcast this week, I've got another fantastic panel of football fans with me. I'm joined by our regular United supporter, Josh. What are you saying, man?
I'm doing well. Good weekend. Good set of results.
Yeah. You're doing all right now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Can't complain. Ole's the man.
Nothing but good vibes.
Jose who?
Let's not talk about that guy.
We won't go there. Not so good weekend of football. Our Fulham fan, Jack.
Hello, mate.
You good?
Yeah. Not so good, but it's okay. We'll live with it. It's okay.
What's happening, man?
Nothing. Everything else is great.
Nothing's happening.
Yeah, you know, Munster Rugby doing grand. Celtic are doing all right.
Nice diversion. I like that. And we also join returning our Italian and South American football expert. I'm going to get it right here. This is the big run-up. Marcella Mora Iraho.
Very good.
It will do.
I don't know why the Italian. South American.
Did I say Italian?
Yeah.
Sorry, South American. Argentinian. Sorry, I don't know where that came from as well. But you're more than welcome to come back. We loved you last time you were on here.
Thank you.
We got you on during the World Cup last time and you were amazing. We got lots of great feedback from your insight and some of your stories as well. So we are glad to have you back here, and there's a reason why we've got you back on the pod, which we'll get to in just a little bit. Before we do that, let's go through some drive-bys, guys. You know the rules. You will have 1 minute each to answer a random football question. Only rules are you cannot be interrupted by anybody else on the panel. I'm going to start with you, Josh. Of these three talented British young players, who do you like the look of the most? Phil Foden at Man City, Brooks at Bournemouth, or Madison at Leicester?
Ooh, that's a tough one.
That is a tough one.
I haven't seen too much of Phil Foden apart from at youth level, so I'm going to discount him just because I just haven't seen enough of him play at senior level. I watched Madison quite a little bit before he came to the league in the championship with Norwich, I believe, and he looked pretty good. David Brooks is one this season. I think you had a question you put a couple of weeks about who is like the best player outside the top six clubs, and he's my best player out of the top six clubs this season. I wasn't on my radar prior to this season, and just been watching quite a lot of Bournemouth, and I think he's a really, really good intelligent player. I'm not sure like if he's like a number 10 or if he's a winger. He kind of hybrid in between the two. So I started the season, I would have said Madison, but I actually put Brooks above him though.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Jack.
Yes.
Will Sarri be at Chelsea game one next season?
I hope so. I think would be my first answer. I hope that Chelsea don't pull another trigger on a manager who needs time to develop a system that, you know, will eventually reap rewards, I believe, in the Premier League. Do I think he will be? Maybe not. You know what Abramovich is like, and you know how happy he is to pull that trigger. But, you know, I really do hope they stick with him. You know, Chelsea are not my, you know, favourite club in the world, being a Fulham fan. Mm-hmm. But I really do think that in order to make the Premier League the best league in the world and continue to develop it in the tandem it's going, you need to keep the best managers in it, and Sarri proved at Napoli that if his system is given time to breathe and flourish, that he can provide some of the most entertaining football in the world. And so I hope that Chelsea stick by him, I hope they back him, and I hope all this kind of really weird chat about trying to revert N'Golo Kante to a like register CDM 6 can stop, because like, at no point in his career has N'Golo Kante played as a solo 6 and sat as a CDM. He's a box to box midfielder. It's just mad to me that everyone is basing Sarri's kind of limitations on the idea that Kante is being played out of position.
And finally, I've got two questions I might ask you. I'm just batting between the two. I'll go with this one. West Ham, they are holding out for 40 million for Arnautovic, who's reported to want to be wanted by a Chinese club. Do you think they should hold out for more and try and get 50 million for him, depending on how desperate the club are? Or if they do that, is there a gamble that they may not get that transfer and then they're left with an unhappy player, and if there's one player unhappy you don't want still on your books, it's someone like Arnautovic? Do you think they should hold out and stand firm for 50 million, or do you think they should get rid of him for whatever price is coming in?
I mean, it's quite a long time for me to discuss that. Like everything, it depends how much they need the money, how much they want the player. My instinct would be 40 million nowadays is quite a good offer. Why would you hold out for more if you've got a system that might work without him. Mm-hmm. But I have absolutely no idea what Pellegrini has in mind. Mm. So you're asking the wrong person. What was the other question?
It was also West Ham related, but it was a bit more nuanced than that as well. I'm just interested to know if you think it's worth generally holding out for a guy that's quite integral to your team, regardless of the player, to get the maximum amount you can, or if you think once, are you of the belief that if a player wants to go, just let him go and get the deal done ASAP?
Well, that's what I mean. I think if a player, years and years ago, I was writing something about polo, which is a sport I've never ever seen, but it was a piece about it, and I spoke to an expert on horses, and I said, "Oh, how much is a polo horse worth, approx?" And he said, "Well, like everything in life, if you want to sell, not very much, but if you don't want to sell, it could be worth quite a lot." And I always remember that line because I think it applies to footballers quite a lot. So, you know, that, I mean, sometimes club presidents or managers who are buying and selling as well, who have that power, will say things like, "I'll say anything about that guy as long as I can sell him," mm-hmm. you know, which kind of meaning I don't really rate him, but I'm going to
talk him up.
An unhappy player or a player that wants to go generally is not a great thing to have. Having said that, a good professional player won't reduce his performance and commitment just because he's not being sold. Mm. So you could be, you can have it out there that there's a transfer happening, or possible. The club are interested in selling, the player's interested in moving, the contract's okay, there's no clause inhibiting, and still get a very good performance and commitment from a good professional athlete. They're not going to kind of go, "Oh, I'm on strike," unless there is particular personality.
Arjen Altovic.
If it was up to me, I wouldn't hold out. If there's 40 million, that seems like a good lot of mm-hmm. money for a club like West Ham as well, you know. But who knows all the incredible kind of complicated variables that come in at the time of doing the deal. You know, mm-hmm. there's so many middlemen, so many factors, so many things that can go wrong. If there's a really bad situation, then get rid of the player, okay. always. But if it's
salvageable,
or if, you know, 10 million is also a lot of money. So if it was a possibility that, in fact, if you hold out for 50, that might happen, I just think that's a little bit...
Okay.
I don't know, it's a money game. It's part and parcel, but also, what would you do?
Oh, putting it back on me. I would probably take a stand and try and hold out for 50. And if he, you know, he's got a long-term contract, but as I mentioned, a personality like Arnautovic is someone that maybe you don't want to be, he could be quite toxic around the dressing room and around the club. But I think that you've got to, you know, I think this idea that clubs can just come and pick your players, I'm not really comfortable with that. And I'd like, he's on a long-term contract. You're my employee. I own you. I want, if you want to buy him, okay, give me 50 million. Now, he's not worth 50 million in my opinion, but I don't want to sell him. So, do you know what I mean? That would be kind of my
you don't want to sell him, but at the same time, you think he could be quite toxic.
Yeah.
So in a way, you do want him out.
Only if he's going to kick up a stink, but yeah, you're being mischievous there. right, let's get into the show now, guys. I want to talk about Marcelo Bielsa. I don't want to focus too much on what's been discussed the last couple of weeks in terms of Spygate, as it's been dubbed. I want to talk more a little bit about him. And I've got three people here who I know various bits about his career and personality. I'll start with you. Let's talk a little bit about the person. What is it about him that the likes of Pep and Pochettino and others rate so much about this individual?
Pep, Pochettino, Alex Ferguson, I remember once playing against him when he was still managing Manchester United and saying this, you know, it's been an honour to be defeated by him. And over the years, the number of players that have played at some point in their career under him, whether it's for Argentina at club level or even Chilean players that I've interviewed, asked randomly who their favourite manager was or who had more of an impact or influence in their life as footballers. It's countless amount. If I had a penny for every time that they name Marcelo, they just without thinking Marcelo. Mascherano springs to mind now, but loads. I don't know exactly what it is, but I think there's a combination of an incredibly respectful and human and kind side to him, and attitude generally. He is a very warm guy, so he's not a, you know, a nasty, bossy dictator. Combined with a very calm, authoritative streak. So I suspect he's very much the person in charge, without a doubt. So he's not pally or jokey. He wouldn't, you know, be a mate. He'd always be the father figure or the teacher figure. But always from a very human and understanding and tolerant approach as a personality. In terms of football, I think he is possibly close to a genius. I mean, I don't know how we would define that or whether there's any point in even trying, but without necessarily always winning, which is obviously an important aspect of the game of football, he has an incredible devotion to the concept of the game, an understanding of the game. As to him, it's, you know, it's a complete thing. It has a meaning. There's something that he wishes to achieve. He likes attacking football. He likes football that's joyful to watch, but not in a kind of deliberate or gratuitously showboaty way. He studies it non-stop, and therefore he is, I guess, completely professional about it, which would mean that working with him must be both exhausting, very demanding, and incredibly rewarding if you also happen to love football as much as he does. And I think the people we've mentioned and the people who tend to rate him highly or be very outspokenly for him, as it were, are people who are very committed to the idea of football as a beautiful game.
Well, on that, I will bring you guys in just a moment. But just on that, one of my questions here was going to be, I'm halfway through reading Pochettino's book, and I get the impression from what I've read so far that he values the process of achieving just as much, if not more, than the actual prize at the end of it. And that's one of the reasons why I think he might stay at Tottenham and not go to United. Is Bielsa a little bit like that? Is the process of trying to win just as valuable as the tangible prize at the end of it to him?
I think definitely, but not just to Bielsa and Pochettino, to a lot of people. Yeah. Certainly in Argentina, where, well, traditionally we always spoke of the Bilardo school of football and the Menotti school of football. Menotti was the manager in 1978 when we won the World Cup, and Bilardo in 1986 when we won the World Cup. And they're completely opposite viewpoints, if you like. Menotti's all about beautiful play, joy, you know, in pleasure. He says it has to do with man's free time. It's a game par excellence. It's a playful a thing of beauty, an art form. Bilard is a territorial kind of strategist. For him, it's a war, and you defend every inch of your territory, come what may, kill or be killed. Both men, I would argue, are more about process than the results. And then the third school of thought, which would be the Bielsa, which came 20 years later or whatever, he's also about that. I mean, famously, Bilardo was incredibly depressed after the 1986 final because Germany had scored against Argentina with a set piece that he had prepared for, and he was like, well, why? He spent 2 days miserable going, how could we let a goal in when we'd prepared so much for it? So to me, that's an example of process mattering more than the result, because it's like, you've won the World Cup, you know, what do you care? At this point, it's all academic. But it is all academic for these guys. And, you know, Sampaoli, who managed Argentina this summer, was also a Bielsa type thinker. I mean, he had a very, very bad experience with Argentina and a very good one with Chile and with Sevilla, with lots of other clubs. He is completely in the Bielsa mold, as is Tata Martino, who we were discussing a little while ago, who just did incredibly well in the States in a very different environment, if you like. So these are men who are committed to the idea of how you do it more than and famously Bielsa was appointed to Argentina by José Pekerman, who had this phrase saying, we must break free from the resultist dictatorship. So it really is it's a very stated objective that the result is irrelevant if what you're doing is
not fun,
caring about the game, whether it's incredibly defensive, incredibly offensive, whether it doesn't matter. It's
And you've met him a couple of times. If we bring up this Bygate that's happened between Leeds and Derby a couple of weeks ago, is that common practice in Argentina and South America? Is that just normal? Were you surprised at the reaction from the British media and British football as to what he'd done? Because he seemed genuinely surprised. Everybody was like, what's the big deal? Is that something back in Argentina, back in South America, that's just, everyone does it? This is normal. This is what you're supposed to do.
Well, Bielsa famously conducts all his training sessions under closed doors and with strict secrecy, and he did it when he took over Chile. He actually made a point of it being less accessible to enter the training ground for anybody. So I think in that sense, that suggests he is aware that people might do it, might go and have a look at the training. And B, that he doesn't want them to. So it's not, I think what was surprising, even to me, and possibly to you guys also, was the extraordinary reaction of outrage. I mean, it seemed like a minor thing. To me, it didn't merit that amount of kind of, until he turned it into a massively brilliant story by his press conference. But I wouldn't say, oh yes, in Argentina all training grounds are completely open and everybody goes, acceptedly to watch their opposition at all. Okay. I just think this idea of formal rules versus informal rules or code or etiquette. There might well be a code or an etiquette that says you must never ever watch your adversary's training.
Yeah.
But he clearly didn't know that this was so marked in England, and I didn't know that. I mean, I didn't think it was that outrageous. I don't know if you all immediately thought, oh my God, he sent someone to watch the...
Well, let's ask Jack. What was your reaction when you heard about this? Did you think that he'd broken a moral code there amongst, there's no written in stone rule there that you can't do it, but did you think, that's not really cool?
Not really, no. As in, you know, people try to gain an advantage either side of the white line as much as possible. Is it any different to going over easily in the box to try and gain yourself an advantage? Is it any different to, you know, trying to incentivize the referee? Or, you know, you look at everything.
But some would say trying to dive in the box for a penalty, there's a huge and, again, tangible benefit.
There's a difference
benefit
between diving and looking for contact and taking contact and going down. And I've always said this, there's a huge difference between actively, you know, not feeling any contact and falling over in order to con the referee, and feeling contact and being like, I'm going to go down even
but
though I can stay up.
But isn't there a minute shy of still cheating? There's a very subtle difference.
Well, of course there's a subtle difference.
I'm not saying I don't want my players to do it, but I'm saying there's They're both.
Morality is a very
immoral,
very, you know, grey area in football, course, isn't it? Yeah, you know, yeah. there are some things that are obviously wrong.
Yeah.
There are some things that are obviously right. And then there's this huge grey area in the middle. And Bielsa's trying to get an advantage over, you know, every coaching adversary. For me, another coach, or, you know, Lampard is inexperienced and all of these things. Another coach goes, he's trying to spy on us. You flip that on its head tactically and you go, he's trying to spy on us because he's scared of us. You know, yeah. you use that as a motivational tool for your players. You use the circumstances in front of you to the best advantage that you can possibly get.
I think a lot of the outrage from a lot of the British managers was more, not so much what he's doing is really, really wrong. I think it's more of a case of, why weren't we doing that?
Vias Boas has said that he did that.
Thing when he said it gives me no advantage whatsoever to do it, didn't
Bielsa
he?
Said that.
Yeah, in the press conference, actually.
I disagree with that. We've had argument. I disagree with
do
that.
Do you? That's really interesting.
The reason he said that interests me, right? The reason he said it is because, not because he's gaining an advantage, but because not exploring every possible opportunity to see if there's an advantage would haunt him to guilt.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
That intrigues me. That's the mark of a perfectionist.
Whether he gets an advantage from it or not is a side issue. The fact is he's doing it because he thinks that there's a potential for an advantage. And I'm cool with that, but I don't agree that there's no advantage to be gained. let me just bring you in, Josh. You need a manager, a permanent manager in the summer. Do you think the fact that he's not won anything, I mean, I know he's won the Olympics, but I don't regard that as a major footballing title, would go against United not appointing or considering someone like him? Or is it the unpredictability, the unpredictable nature of his character that you think may also go against him being considered as the long-term United boss?
Yeah, I think it's probably more to do with longevity. He's been in the game quite a long time, mm-hmm. and haven't really been operating at the top level of European football for much of that time.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit like Sarri before he went to Napoli.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that probably discounts him from the United job.
Mm-hmm. Do you think
probably also the unpredictability of his character. Not that it's a bad thing.
Yeah.
But I think he isn't somebody who you, like a board, would feel like they could control. Like situation, I think he went to Lazio.
He left after one day.
Rightly, because the terms of the agreement to go to Lazio and the funds that they were supposed to make available and everything turned out that it wasn't available.
Okay.
So he left.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to what Conte did at Juventus,
mm-hmm.
When he left before the start of the season. So I think that kind of shows that A, he's a perfectionist, but he's also a principled person.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't stick to the terms of the agreement, he has no issue from walking away, even if it's going to hurt him financially.
Sure.
I think he's probably not somebody, if you are like a full chairman, technical director, you wouldn't go and hire him unless you knew that you were able to deliver what you say you're going to deliver to him. If you're not going to deliver what you say you're going to deliver to him, don't bother hiring him because he'll walk up.
Mm-hmm.
That's just me.
Also, a club like United, it's a results based business, right? You know,
yeah.
There's not, you know, there's one thing obviously trying to play beautiful football and all of those things, but you know, there is a level at a top six club in the UK that, you know, you're expected to get results.
Not Tottenham.
Okay.
And that's
all
not
right.
even a
no,
shot.
No, not even. That's, okay.
Arsenal as well was at Wembley.
Oh, all right. Whoa.
So let's just take this, you know, wind back from that a second and just, you know, that Bielsa is, you know, on top of being a wonderful manager, is a philosopher, a football philosopher.
Mm-hmm.
And outside of Johan Cruyff, I don't think there's a person that's had more drastic influence on the modern game of football than Bielsa. The only other person you maybe have in this account is Louis van Gaal, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And the amount of people he's affected, the amount of people he's influenced, and you look at the managers in the modern game who look to him as a kind of a role model, and you know, you hear Guardiola and Pochettino, and all these managers look to him as a role model and a kind of the person that influenced their thoughts, and you know, even people like Juan Melillo and, you know, Oscar Garcia to a point, and all these people have come out and said that. You know, Bielsa has been a massive influence on them, on top of, you know, the already mentioned Sampaoli, Tata Martino. And I think to therefore, you know, it would be a huge gamble for someone like United, who already gambled on a philosopher type like Van Gaal.
Mm-hmm. It didn't work.
And it didn't work.
Yeah.
Because, but it didn't not work because, you know, I think that Van Gaal, given time and given, would have actually completed a project at United, but the fans got on his back and he wasn't delivering what they wanted, and then the board had to make a change. Yeah. And they went against all of their principles and then employed the one manager who
goes against
that goes against all of those principles.
I would say, please don't mention that guy's name.
My president's
in it. I think it's crucial what you're saying about time to complete a project. This, these are guys that they go, you know, the word project is their baby. That's what they like. They don't do a season and see what happens and think it's over. And they might get there and walk out after a day or after 2 months or whatever because they're not given the kind of freedom or the conditions to work the way they want. Mm-hmm. But their idea, and that's why I mention Arsenal, because they clearly did it with someone, whether or not, you know, it was worth it or it dragged on too long. But I did think, oh my God, Bielsa should come to Arsenal before he took the Leeds job. Mm-hmm. And before Unai was appointed. But I think it's that the places that are able to think in terms of a generation rather than a season.
Now.
And I think with Argentina, although he took Argentina to 2002 World Cup and they left earlier than ever before with less points in the history of Argentina's World Cup. Mm-hmm. So it was disastrous in a way. But at the same time, he had a generation to work there. And everything he's done, from building changing rooms that are adequate at the training ground, to creating a video library, to implementing the use of statistics, to working with the youth developers, with nourishment experts and psychology, everything he's done laid a foundation for 20 years. Although we only won gold at the Olympics, which is great.
I had an argument with a friend about on the weekend about whether a gold medal at Olympics is a major footballing title. I don't think it is. He argued vehemently that it is, but that's another argument for another day. Just one more question. I've got to move on. We could do this all day, but I just want to explore the idea that was mentioned about just going back to this idea of putting good football and philosophy of playing football over the actual prize, because I'm a football fan. In the last couple of years, has kind of changed my thinking on what I want from football, my football team. And obviously, I want to win the Premier League, I want to win the big trophies. Obviously, it's always about winning. But I looked at Jose United, and I looked at Liverpool last year under Klopp. Sorry, Josh. And that for me crystallised what football, being a football fan, is all about. Jose won two trophies a year before at United, but the United fans hated him. And Liverpool fans last year won nothing, but they loved watching their team every single week because they loved the football and they had moments. And for me, football has become more about the moments that you enjoy. Isn't, Josh is taking a deep sigh there, but the idea that football managers now, like Pochettino, valuing good football and the process as important as trophies, can you see that changing and infiltrating top clubs like United, whereby they may change their philosophy on, actually, we're not going to live and die by what we win and what we don't win. We're going to actually value a long process, even if it means going through some growing pains.
Personally, I value the game itself over and above results, to the point that I think a draw should be considered a legitimate result for any big cup or competition. I think you should just say, well, they drew. There's no winner. It was a draw. And people laugh at me. They have been with me 20 years. Well, you know, why not? I don't understand the idea that somebody has to win. Is that going to take off? I doubt it very much. There's the money, obviously. Mm-hmm. You know, you get more money for winning big things, and money's a very important part of the industry. I think some fans often say, oh, if I heard that we cheated, or if I didn't like the way we won that, I would give back that trophy, or I wouldn't count it. I've even heard players say that. I would return the medal if that was the case. Ultimately, the majority of people, I think, would rather win, have the trophy, have it in the cabinet, feel like they're a winner somehow. I mean, I did hear quite recently someone say, oh, saying we won when your football team wins is saying like, oh, I had sex after watching a porn movie or something. But I keep saying it myself. I just felt compelled to share that with you. We won. I think that moment of we won, which everyone feels so, you know, in first person, like they actually won it, or we lost, like, you know, just now some people around this table were feeling incredibly personally like they had actually not achieved something. But I doubt it would take on, but I do think it doesn't need to take on further. There's enough love of football in fans, especially more than in the press and in the directors' boards, I think, that just appreciate the good quality of a game and like to see it happen. And there's emblematic players that represent that. You know, Riquelme springs to mind, but that's another conversation. Now in charge of Argentina's.
We could do this all
there's
day.
There's a quote I've just wanted to sort of
super briefly.
I can't find the exact one, but there's something saying that, you know, people who like football like Brazil. People who love football adore Argentina, and I think there's something in that, in the way that, you know, the Brazil are so obsessed with winning things, and the process is so much more intrinsic to a kind of, you know, generation of Argentinian managers, that there is something in that, that it's more than just a results business, and it's more than just entertainment. It is the, you know, the be all and end all in terms of defining yourself.
Agree. Thank you very much, Carmen. I know you got to go, so thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
An Argentinian podcast special alone, because there's so many things I want to develop. And a friend of mine also on the weekend was he was said to me about Messi, and he was saying it was Jack at work, Joe, about Messi. It could be put forward that because he's not won a major international tournament, that he's not one of the greatest of all time. And when you put him alongside other footballers who have won at international level, and I disagreed with him, but it got me thinking about what the greatest. Anyway, that's best for a wider podcast on Messi and other things as well. But thanks for coming in. Thank you very much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you, as always. All right, let's pick up now, guys. I want to talk about Leicester City. Let's talk about what's happened with them and their manager Klopp. Well, there's been lots of disgruntled Leicester City fans this season, that's many of whom want him out and are not happy with what they're seeing at Leicester. I'll start with you, Josh. From what you're seeing from an outsider, do you think it's actually that bad, and can you understand why certain Leicester fans are not happy with what they're seeing and many are calling for his head?
Not really. The only time I was concerned for Claude Puel was when he wasn't playing Vardy.
Okay.
And I kind of just thought, why would you put Jamie Vardy on the bench of all people in Leicester, in that Leicester team? So it's a little period. It's only a very short period. I think there was a little bit of a disagreement between him and Jamie Vardy, and he left him out a couple of times. I mean, Jamie Vardy wasn't really in the best of form anywhere at that time, maybe. And I think he was playing in Nacho instead. I mean, Leicester are what, ninth in the table?
In the eighth, yeah.
Eighth or ninth in the table. They are about kind of where you expect them to be in the table, right? Maybe even punching slightly above their weight when you consider like the players that they've lost since when they won the title, right? I look at their team and I don't think they're blessed with that much time. They've lost Mahrez, they've lost Kante, they've lost Drinkwater. Wes Morgan still playing at the centre of the defence. I think he's, you know,
he's stretching it.
Yeah. You know, they need to replace him. Danny Simpson sometimes still plays that right back, although they've got that Pereira guy there as well. One of the better players in the league, one of the better signings in James Maddison, who's been really, really good. And Jamie Vardy, who's continues to score goals, continues to torment the top six clubs, scoring lots of goals against them. What I don't know is, I haven't watched Leicester's games a lot, only when they played in United and played a few or others of the top six clubs. So I don't know what the style of football is like per se, whether it's boring to watch. But I mean, he's getting the max. I would say he's punching where they are on the table right now. They're punching above their weight.
So, Jack, does this kind of play a little bit into the convo we had earlier on about enjoying the football you're watching? Because from what I'm hearing from Leicester fans is, yeah, we're eighth and it's great, but the football is dull as dishwater. Now, I've seen quite a lot of Leicester games, quite a few this year and last year. And granted, some of those games there haven't been great watches, but they said, you know, they, a lot of Leicester fans were saying that, you know, they were obviously sinking under Ranieri and then Craig Shakespeare. This guy's got them back up in comfortably into the top 10. Can you, if you're Leicester, can you have both? Can you have entertaining football and be competing for a European place? Or well, do you have to accept that it's going to be either or?
I don't think the two things are, you know, completely polar opposites. You can be a good footballing side and challenge for these positions, you know, per se Wolves. But, you know, at the same time, you know, what do Leicester want? You know, they play a functional 4-4-2, basically, with, you know, with Vardy and Iheanacho up front a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. They have, you know, the only thing I would argue for Leicester fans in the kind of retrospect is actually that their first 11 is really quite good. It's just that they have almost no depth.
Nothing behind that.
So when you look at Ricardo Pereira, Ben Chilwell, you have two of, I think, you know, some of the most attacking fullbacks in the league. Both of them really good on the ball. Both of them able to deliver a good cross. Pereira has an absolute rocket in his locker. Mm-hmm. You add Maddison to that, who's been really good on the wings. You obviously Demarai Gray, Harvey Barnes came in back in at the weekend, did really well.
One of the best keepers in the league as well.
One of the best keepers in the league, Schmeichel and Iheanacho and Vardy. So you've obviously got
good players.
You know, a team that are able to compete on the other side, and you know, Maguire and Evans at centre half is a good centre half pairing. That, you know, it's not, they paid a lot of money for, you know, the likes of Harry Maguire. Mm-hmm. They didn't pay very much for Johnny Evans. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, they've been able to build a squad which looks able to compete on this kind of level. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you want to compete and go and play in Europe, and you want to do it in a 4-4-2 system, there's very little you're going to be able to do without making some sort of drastic changes. You can go and play lovely football in a 4-3-3 or in a, but they won the league playing a very functional counter attacking 4-4-2. That's where they've got best at, right?
But that seems to be why they're pissed off, because they're saying that Claude Puel's taken them away from that directness. He's got them playing a little bit more build up football, and they're saying this isn't what we do. So are they right to be a little bit like, well, why are you changing what works? Or do you have to accept them when a new guy comes in, he's doing it his way, and in terms of results, it's working?
It looks all right to me. I'd be very, very pleased sitting in eighth and and playing, you know, function. But it's not the long ball over the top football that we saw a long time under Ranieri and even Shakespeare. But at the same time, you can't just keep playing counter attacking football when you're eighth in the league. Mm-hmm. They were only able to play that because everybody underestimated them from start to finish, right? And everyone played those high lines. And Vardy, if you're now playing against Jamie Vardy and you play a high line, you're insane.
Also, another gripe of theirs is the cups. The, you know, Leicester aren't going to get relegated. They're not going to break the top six. And Puel has put out weakened teams in the cups.
Well,
that seems to be another reason.
Yeah, this isn't just Claude Puel, though, right? This is more or less all of the Premier League managers outside of the top six clubs.
Yeah, but a lot of those clubs you're talking about, they will have relegation to focus on.
I know, so there's like, you know, below the top six, above like the relegation, there's that middle set of clubs, mm-hmm. your Wolves, your
West Ham,
Crystal Palace, the West Hams, etc., that don't necessarily, Watford for instance, that kind of filled weakened teams in the cups. Because the Premier League, like, finishing, the difference between finishing 12th and 8th is millions, mm-hmm. right? So that's really the problem. And on top of that, if you look at Leicester's squad, they don't have the biggest squad.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you come out of the Christmas period of fixtures and then you've gone straight into the FA Cup and, you know, you've just played 5 games in however many weeks, mm-hmm. 3 weeks or something like that, and then you've got the FA Cup to come along. So you think, oh, when do we rest players? Do I rest players? Do I start changing my team in that Christmas period of Premier League fixtures, or do I start doing it in the FA Cup? And the FA Cup is like the obvious place to do that, especially if you're going to play a team which is like from the Championship maybe or something like that.
I think they went out to Newport.
Yeah, this is what I'm going to say. I think that argument about fielding weakened teams in the Cup if you've not really got anything else going on in your season is a good one. And I think that if you actually are going to finish 8th to 12th, your fans would always rather you had a decent Cup run and had a go at
it.
And I completely appreciate that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, Claude Puel put out a side that should have been able to beat Newport County.
Mm-hmm.
That fault lies with the players that played against Newport County and were unable to, you know, penetrate basically against I've watched Newport in the Cup this year live, and they were quite poor. They nearly lost to Met Police. Let's not even talk about it. I went to Met Police to watch it in the first round, and Newport were really bad that day and nearly got done by a semi-pro side.
But I think you've got a point, but then the fans would say, why risk it? Just put Vardy in, just put the first team in, go 4-0 up at half time and then get players.
But it goes back to Josh's point. Like, we just said that Leicester's squad is good in the first team and weak on the outskirts, right? So therefore, you've got at some point not to try and injure all your players towards the end of the season, and that involves resting them at key points. They should have had enough with the squad he put out to beat Newport County, and that fault lies with the players, not just Puel.
Is it so weak that they could have got dragged into relegation zone? Let's say they do get Vardy injured in an FA Cup game for 6 weeks. Yeah. Schmeichel gets a red card, he's out for 3 games. Is that going to affect them so much that they're going to drop into relegation battle?
They would be in the next round of the FA Cup, they'd have those players missing. Yeah. So what's the point getting them injured in round? You know, it's
one worry about that then.
But obviously, if you're in a quarter final and you stop playing the first team against a good side, I completely appreciate it. Or even if it was a championship side, I would have been like, play them and get through the round. But against
that
Newport,
team was good enough to...
Yeah, against Newport, who are league two, right? Mm-hmm. You have the ability to beat that team with your second string, like Shinji Okazaki played. These are players that are able to play against Newport and should be able to win. Yeah, you can't just lay that at the manager.
There's a slight, like, there's two things here, right? There's like, I don't blame the manager. Basically, my point I'm trying to make here is that I don't blame the manager. I don't blame Claude Puel. Mm-hmm. I blame the club. I blame the club who's setting the objectives, whoever the sporting director is.
True.
Obviously, saying that the FA Cup is not important. Staying in the Premier League is more important, so therefore you make your decisions when you're picking your squad. Like, it's almost like, I don't know, I'm going to reduce it to a game, but it's almost like when you play Football Manager and you look at your competitions and it says not important,
the objectives,
Carabao Cup not important. Mm-hmm. So what do you do when you play Carabao Cup?
You mug it off.
Yeah. And so that's what he's doing. He's basically looking at it thinking, well, I'm not going to get sacked if he loses to Newport, so why am I going to risk my best players, who my objective is obviously to, he must have some sort of objectives, mm-hmm. where he needs to finish in the league table, right? And that's what he's being judged against, and it's his job. It's at the end of the day, that's going to be put at risk if he doesn't meet that objective. The other part to thing to say is that the problem really is when you change a whole 11, it doesn't even matter how good you are, right? I don't recall what the 11 was he put out against Newport, but I'm going to guess 70% of them haven't played games together much this season, mm-hmm. right? And so you're doing that against a team who have been playing together week in, week out. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it doesn't matter how good you are. It's chemistry on the pitch, rhythm, all of it can come into play. And you do risk losing, but the point really is that I don't think that these managers are being told that by their club that the cup's game is important. Otherwise they wouldn't do that.
Final question. I've mentioned this before about Puel because I actually like him, but do you feel a lot of the negativity from a lot of Leicester fans and to some degree the media is because of his personality? He doesn't give great lines. He doesn't jump into the crowd when they score. He's not, do you know what I mean? He's a little bit, you know, on the face of it, quite bland. So therefore, the agenda from the media is we don't get great lines from him. He doesn't give us great, you know, outbursts. Mm-hmm. We're gonna slightly slant towards, not slagging him off, but there's a negative slant on the perception of Claude Puel.
Yeah, I mean, he is quite a bland character, mm-hmm. so I can see how that can come across. And if you look at somebody like a Jurgen Klopp, who the media really like,
because he gives them lines and he gives them
character, and it kind of gets leeway when things go wrong and things like that. So I can see that angle coming into it, but probably as well, because I remember when he was at Southampton, they wanted him out as well, and the main reason I got from Southampton's fan was because the football was also bland. So I mean, this is like speaking as a Man United fan, 2 years or 3 years of really, really bland football, probably even more if I think about Moyes and LVG. So quite a lot of bland football. It's not great going to a stadium watching boring football. I'm going to say that it's not great, but you do have to be realistic about what you have, right? So I think that sometimes, because I will say this, playing attacking football, in my opinion, I know this is just my opinion, it might be wrong, playing attacking football is more risky
Yeah.
Than playing defensive football. Mm-hmm. And so if you, especially if you don't have the better players, because the more attacking you are, the more
open you are,
right? Mm-hmm. And if you have better players than the opposition, then it's good because you keep the ball longer, mm-hmm. which means that that could act as a defense for you. But if you're a Leicester, who I guess half of the teams you're going to go up against in the Premier League are either going to be better or at your level, mm-hmm. it's more of a risk to play openly and expansive football.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So what I would then say then is that you have to weigh up where you are in the table versus like the type of football you're playing and the players that you have.
Okay.
And I don't necessarily think that when you talk about the Leicester squad, I don't necessarily think that they invest enough for them to, for instance, I look at Wolves' investment and Leicester's investment, and Wolves play better football than them. Mm. But you can say, is it the investment or is it the manager? Maybe it's both. Never really seen Claude Poole play great football, so maybe it's just him.
Okay, so that's what the boys think about what's happening at Leicester City. Let's bring in Rob Tanner, a big Leicester City fan from the Leicester Mercury and also writer of the book 5000 to 1. Rob, how you doing, mate?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you.
Cheers for coming on the pod, mate. So let me just start off by asking this. There's a lot of, where we hear a lot from Leicester fans how they're not really happy. They're not really happy about what's happening at the club under Claude Puel. But is it really that bad? Because you're eighth in the league. And I know you're quite a distance off the top six, but is it really as bad as us outsiders are hearing from the fans?
Well, I think the main problem is there's been some underwhelming performances on home soil, and when you consider 90% of your fan base are only going to see you at home, that's the sort of image that they get of where Leicester City are going under Claude Puel. I think the title win in 2016 has raised expectations as well to another level, and I think if you'd said 3 years ago or 4 years ago before they'd won the title that, you know, the Leicester City would be sitting eighth in the table, I'm sure the fans would be happy. But I think the one criticism that's been fired at not just one, he's been hitting with different sticks from all angles at the moment, but the biggest criticism is the style of play at home, which seems quite negative and defensive. But he has played with three holding midfielders, and that has worked against sides like Chelsea and Man City we saw before Christmas, when they could sit back, soak up pressure and play on that classic counter-attack which served them so well in the title-winning season. When they come up against the likes of Cardiff and some of the other sides struggling near the bottom, Southampton recently, and they adopt the same approach, it hasn't quite worked because the emphasis is then on Leicester City to force the issue, and they've been lacking a bit of creativity in the final third. But I think what realistic Leicester fans understand is that this is a team very much in transition under Claude Puel. He's trying to change the style of play, not completely go away from the counter-attack, but just add a few more strings to their bow at the
moment. Well, I'm going to get to Claude in just a second, but it's funny you mentioned earlier on about the possibility that some Leicester fans, the expectations have been overinflated in relation to winning the title just a few years ago. But, you know, I look at your team, Rob, you've got one of the best goalkeepers in the league, one of the best goal scorers in the league, you've got one of the most exciting right backs in the league, one of the young English prospects in Madison in the league as well. You've got some good players in midfield. I like Ndidi. You know, what is for Leicester City fans a good season? Because only a couple of years ago, you were almost, you know, there was concerns you might even go down.
Well, since the Premier League title win 2016, that landscape has changed. Because Leicester City shocked the world by doing what they did in 2016, it embarrassed some of the bigger clubs who have seen a little club like Leicester City on a minimum budget mm-hmm. compared to their own go on and win the title. So it's changed everything. Since then, you've seen Pep come in at Man City, you've seen Klopp come in at Liverpool, you've seen massive investment at these clubs, and that top six now looks set in stone. So I think it's unrealistic for me personally that Leicester City will be, considering they're going through transition, would be challenging that top six now. So in that case, seventh would probably be the highest they could reach.
Sure.
You could say seventh would be the best of the rest, and up until recently they were seventh, mm-hmm. yet there was a section of the fans that still weren't happy. And I don't think it, and what was often said to me wasn't so much the results, because, you know, over Christmas you couldn't argue with winning away at Chelsea and Everton and beating Man City at home. There was no argument there. They were then saying it was the style of play that they weren't happy with. It was the negative football, the defensive mindedness of Claude Puel. But since then, they've lost four of the last five games in all our competitions, including that embarrassment at Newport County in the FA Cup. And now the same fans are saying that they want results. Results are the most important thing. That's what Claude should be judged on, not necessarily the style of play. So I think there's a confusion among the fan base as well of what they actually want at the moment. I think they're, I mean, the fans, Leicester City fans are incredibly loyal, and they're incredibly loyal to those lads that won the title for them in 2016. You mentioned Kasper Michael there, and, you know, they stick by those lads because they won't forget what they achieved for the football club. But I think they're getting frustrated because they feel that this club is not progressing. This is the fundamental problem. I think they don't think that the club has built on that title win.
On Claude Puel, do you think that he suffers from the fact that he's not an Antonio Conte or a Jurgen Klopp that runs into the crowd when his team scores? He's not a Jose Mourinho or, I don't know, a manager that's going to give the press great lines and comes out
Absolutely.
With really fun. Because he's perceived as being quite dull, that makes him an easy target to dislike. When really, I think at Southampton and at Leicester, generally, I think he's doing a good job. Do you think that because of the lack of perceived personality, that is maybe going against him?
Absolutely, yeah. That's a very valid point. Sometimes, I mean, I've written this in the Mercury many times as well. There's a lot to admire about what Claude's trying to do, bringing on the youth and that. But sometimes he doesn't help himself because he refuses to play the media game. And also, I mean, things like when they've had a big win. You know, if they'd won at Chelsea before Christmas, if that had been Jurgen Klopp, he'd been running up down the touchline, saluting the away fans, punching the air.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
But Claude doesn't do that. He doesn't do that. He is quite animated in the technical area, but it's not directed in any one direction. It's not. He doesn't run towards the fans. He doesn't go towards them and punch the air in delight and
sure.
things like that. And in press conference, you know, he is very softly spoken. I mean, I remember his first press conference. They had to pause it when it first started and turn all the mics up because we couldn't hear what he was saying. So, you know, does come across that way. And having had Claudio Ranieri, who was meant to quote, who knew how to play the game.
Yeah.
Because this isn't about him being a foreign coach. It's just about personalities.
Yeah.
Because Claudio Ranieri came in and he won the media over because he identified very early on that if you give them a soundbite, if you give them a little line they can hang everything else on.
You get them on side.
In a press conference, you've got them on side and they won't be asking the really, really difficult questions. And of course it helps when you're, you know, charging towards the title as well.
That was great. Rob, cheers for your time, man. Thanks for coming on the pod.
No problem, mate.
Cheers, pal.
I want to talk just very briefly about a handful of managers in the kind of middle part of the Premier League. I just want to have a discussion with you guys about how well you think they're doing and kind of what you think they're bringing to the league. And let's just go for them. The first one, Garcia at Watford. Jack, I don't know how much of Watford you've seen this year.
Yeah.
Are they slightly going under the radar a little bit? Or is the job that he's doing, and is he going under the radar just a little bit? They're 11 points off United, but they're leading the pack of teams in that race for the Everton Cup.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It doesn't seem to have a complicated philosophy from what I see of them. It seems to be quite simple. Playing players in their positions, keeping the ball, and let's get the ball wide and get it into the box. Fairly simple stuff.
Yeah.
Do you think that the job he's doing is going slightly unnoticed?
Yeah, I think Gracia is a wonderful manager, and he is one of those people that just seems to adapt to the philosophy of the club that he's at. You know, we spoke about Bielsa earlier and having his systems and basically not deviating from those systems. Grassi is the other type of manager, and it's not, you know, saying one is better than the other or whatever. It's just, you know, two styles of management. And what he's doing is saying, right, these are the players I have. These are the formations I want to play in. And, mm-hmm. and therefore, I'm going to have to match those two things up in order to get the best out of players. You know, some players are system players and some players, you know, enjoy themselves a little bit more when given the freedom to roam. And I think what he's done with the likes of Pereira, with De La Feo this year, who's again having a good season. Mm-hmm. Will Hughes is doing okay. player. He hasn't been in the team recently, but he seems to be doing all right from what I've been seeing of him. And yeah, I think that under the radar, Watford are just slightly sitting there doing their business, going about it quietly, and Gracia's doing a wonderful job.
He seems to have kind of kept things quite calm there, because by now normally they implode and something bad happens at Watford, and do you know what I mean, the wheels come off the bus there. But he seems to be just doing the job quietly. Don't really hear too much about what he's doing, but just going about his business.
Yeah, I'm gonna reserve judgment until they get 40 points.
Okay.
Because I think this is, I've seen this with Watford a few times, is that they kind of go through the season and punching above their weight slightly,
mm-hmm.
doing better than expected. Players like Dini are
hungry,
I think they get to 40 points and then everything starts to like go backwards.
Yeah. 40 points for some reason. More than enough this season, though. That's the thing.
Yeah.
The other thing that's kind of nuts about Gracia is that this season, I can't remember the exact statistic, but it's the first season Watford have started a season with the same manager as they ended the season before in about 10 years or 7 years or something like that.
Okay.
Which is mental. And it's the first time he's had a proper pre-season with the same manager, who knows his players, been able to bring in a few reinforcements that he appreciates and knows. And look what they're doing. You know, they're just coasting along, getting the points where they need. I remember them dropping points at Craven Cottage after they absolutely battered us mm-hmm. for the first half. Mm-hmm. And then we ended up battering them for the second half. And really should have won it. We hit the bar in the dying seconds. But, you know, even with those kind of results, where he's just going, it's actually all right to go away to Fulham and get a point, as long as we beat Fulham at home. Yeah. You know, we it's okay to go to Palace or Cardiff, or if we go and get points there and then we beat those teams at home, we're going to be absolutely fine. And that's what he's done. He's been quietly effective, quietly efficient. He's stolen points off a number of the top six already. Mm-hmm. You know, points, and you don't need those points to stay up, really. Mm. What you need is just to do the business around the teams around you. And I think he's doing a wonderful job.
Pellegrini, stick with you, Jack. I thought this was quite a good appointment.
Yeah.
The reason why I thought it was a good appointment was because teams like West Ham seem to kind of go on about needing someone that gets the club. We need a West Ham guy that gets us. And I thought that's part of why the reason why they've not done well.
Agreed.
Then you need someone that's the complete opposite, that's not invested in the club, not a former legend, not a former pledge, someone that can come in from a cold point of view and look at the team and be like, this is what we need to do, rather than someone that beats their chest and is West Ham through and through. What do you make of the job that Manuel Pellegrini's done there so far?
Yeah,
or am I speaking too early? Because West Ham, it can be 3 months of great and then 3 months they lose every game. Do you know what I mean?
Of course. And obviously they're you know, temporarily about to enter crisis with Arnautovic on the way out and Yarmolenko out injured and all those things. Andy Carroll missing sitters from 10 seconds out. It's one of those clubs where chaos always seems like it's just around the corner. But I think you're absolutely spot on. There's so much like furore and like rush around West Ham. They're always like, ah, it's West Ham. Like, yeah. I think they needed someone just to come in and be like, I don't care about any of this. I'm just going to deal with the players on the pitch and the rest of you can get out of here as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, it started off really badly this season. It looked a bit like, do you remember when Everton bought all those players and none of them worked because they didn't fit the system at all? And I was like, here we go, West Ham have just bought loads of players and it's not going to work. But slowly they've all integrated. He's worked out who his best players are, the system that suits them best. Felipe Anderson is having some season, you know, it's since November onwards. I think we talked about earlier, but I think the player outside the top six for me would be Felipe Anderson. And, you know, with that and with the kind of calmness of Pellegrini at the helm, they seem to just be sailing on steadier waters. But, you know, like I say, it can always collapse.
I'm with Jack on that. But is there a fear that the calmness is so unusual and new to West Ham fans? It gets calm and it gets almost a bit boring that they almost circumvent problems themselves just to keep it interesting and just to keep it dramatic. Calm isn't very good at West Ham. They don't do calm very well.
Let's see how this Arnautovic situation plays out. About West Ham is that I think Pellegrini is a good choice to go there. And I know that a couple of people thought he didn't really fit the team. Well, I thought he was good to go there because he has a way of playing that he understands and wants to impose.
Mm-hmm.
And because he's won something before. Mm-hmm. And I feel like West Ham fans I don't want to be too disrespectful, but I feel like a lot of them have expectations way above their club. And I get the feeling that this season for Pellegrini, going along as it is, if it carries on like this, they'll be happy. Next season, if he doesn't elevate the team,
you want top six. Top six, otherwise get out.
They'll be calling for his head.
Yeah.
And I get the feeling that West Ham fans, along with a couple of other teams I'm not going to mention, can be a little bit impatient when it comes to a manager coming in and the club trying to transition to a new phase. And I feel like with getting a new stadium and, you know, spending lots of money on players like Felipe Anderson, there is going to come to a point where fans start saying, well, making this investment, like, where's the trophies?
Eighth isn't good enough anymore.
Like, where's our FA Cup? Where's our Europa League place? Where are we going to challenge the top four? And I hope that doesn't happen too soon, because I feel like Pellegrini, if he's there for a couple of years, can really take them forward.
Just super briefly on Pellegrini as well, is another one of his skills at West Ham in particular is that he's managed to manage up as well as manage down.
Yeah, I think so. He just seems to be doing I think that goes for a lot of things in terms of managing up and down, in terms of the teams he's beating and the teams he's beating underneath him and above him.
But also
managing personalities. Arnautovic is notoriously difficult to deal with, you know, that's well known in football circles. And in the same breath, he's brought Declan Rice up to becoming, you know, arguably top three CDMs in the Premier League right now, on form, if not on talent. And I think that being able to put those two personalities, which seem, you know, in retrospect, miles apart, and put them in the same team and have them working together and towards the same goal, I think it's got to be a good thing, especially, you know, like I say, it's chaos, isn't it, at West Ham, carnage.
But I mean, up as in, sorry, I should have explained, up as in board level. He's managed to keep them happy as well as keeping the fans and the players happy.
I think he was a coup because I think they wouldn't have been able to sign some of the players they signed
without him,
had he not been the manager. Okay. Or someone of his caliber.
So they've kept their mouths shut because they know that those good players have come.
Because they're not going to get a manager with his CV. I don't think they would have, like, if I could think about the managers that probably would have been
in the mix
to get the job, his CV is probably the best. Right? So I think he comes in with a lot of holding most of the cards in that situation.
All right, Espirito Santo at Wolves. Stick with you, Josh. I like him. I like him because he doesn't chat crap. A lot of managers talk rubbish. When I listen to his interviews a lot, he doesn't talk nonsense. Mm-hmm. He never makes excuses. Mm-hmm. I've never heard him post-match make an excuse after a defeat. And also as well, just to come up from a journalist point of view myself, he makes journalists ask good questions. I've seen his reaction on his answers to a lot of questions that he's asked. Mm-hmm. And it makes me think, if you ask a stupid question, he'll generally give you either no answer or he'll give you a stupid answer. And I kind of like that.
Yeah.
It's not nice being that guy post-match asking a question and you kind of get shut down. I've been there. It's not nice, but it makes you ask a good question. I like that about him. What do you think about the job that he's done?
I like his team. I like his personality. I like similar things that what you mentioned, that he's not an excuse maker. Mm-hmm. I like that he wants to, I'm kind of like, you know, you got the two kind of philosophies of football, like winning is the most important thing, and then you have how you play and entertaining, and then entertaining and winning. Obviously I'm more on the entertaining and winning side, but if you're not going to win, entertain. And I think he approaches football in a way to entertain, in a way to play football, he allows players to express themselves, but at the same time he has the balance, right? Because he actually plays, if you watch Wolves, they don't necessarily play the same way every game. Seems like he really thinks about his opponent and thinks, okay, these are our strengths, these are their weaknesses, how can we use what we have to beat this team, but also play a style of football which is enjoyable to watch. Mm-hmm. I've never really seen him go towards parking the bus. I've always seen him offer an attacking threat, even if he thinks that. I think when they played Liverpool before, played on a counter attack. It's not like we're just going to park the bus and we're going to kick the ball forward. He has a way of how he sets his team up. They know exactly where they need to play the ball. Each player knows where they need to run as soon as they get the ball. And I like that about him because to me, he's somebody who thinks about the game tactically really well.
Jack, how much of the fact that he's managed to get the likes of Moutinho and Patricio there and keep the likes of Neves. We'll see in the summer what happens with him, but there's not really much talk about Neves going in this window for sure. Do you think a lot of that is attributed to the fact that they're just, it's him, they like playing for him, they like playing the football that he's making them play? Because there's some, you know, big personalities for a club like Wolves. How much of the players that he's got there do you attribute to his style of management?
You can't discount the importance of George Mendes,
the agent, yeah.
And his influence at Wolves, but that said, no player of that caliber that you've just mentioned is going to want to play for an unsuccessful manager or a manager who doesn't seem to inspire that kind of confidence in them. Having been in the Championship with Wolves last year and then coming up with them, they're probably the team I've watched second most of Fulham in the last 2 years. I love what Nuno is doing there. Absolutely. I think he's a wonderful manager. I really liked what he did at Valencia. I thought he got a little bit short shrift at Porto with this kind of tenure there, because he came second and didn't win anything. And, you know, the Portuguese league is kind of one of those ones where if you don't win anything as Porto manager, you get sacked immediately.
<You're> done, yeah.
Even though he played some really nice football and stuff. But look, last year they played a 3-4-3, which, it, you know, always was exactly the same pretty much, and they kind of didn't really adapt to anyone else. They just played their way because they were by far and away the best team in the Championship, and they had a Premier League quality team playing a division below. It's clever because he's kept most of that team together. He's upgraded where he's needed to upgrade. Bringing Moutinho in, I think, is an absolutely phenomenal bit of business. Mm-hmm. At first, I was a little bit sceptical because I thought he was going to try and play him as a 10, where he's kind of become that kind of more reduced player in terms of offensive nature later on. But bringing him in and allowing them to kind of revert occasionally to a 3-5-2 allows them to play on the counter, brings Romain Saiss in a little bit deeper to kind of hold. But more importantly, I think he's kept the back three the exact same. And they know each other. They've played with each other for a year and a half now. They're very solid. Bringing in Patricio for John Ruddy was an upgrade in that position, although I do think they should be immediately relegated because he wears the number 11 shirt in goal. I do say that with all truth. But, you know, Matt Doherty, I think, has been the most effective right back in the league this season, and I think him going forward, he's a special, special player. Johnny's done really well on the other side, and Ruben Vinagre is in there as a backup. So they've got, you know, Portugal's best left back prospect backing up a current Spanish international, you know, in terms of what they've got for depth. And then the likes of Gibbs White's coming through, Adama Traore's young, Jota, Helder Costa, Cavaleiro, and they're all playing off Jimenez, and then Bonatini as a backup. There's a really good squad there. He's adapting it to play his different opponents. He's managing that squad really well. Everyone seems really happy in that camp. I was there for the FA Cup game against Liverpool. Obviously, it wasn't a full strength Wolves team, but it was, you know, mostly there.
Yeah, yeah.
And the celebrations, I was in there lucky enough to be around the celebrations in the dressing rooms afterwards. And it was such a united camp. Everyone's put on such a, you know, everyone seems really happy. I spoke to Connor Cody afterwards. He was absolutely, all he wanted to do was praise his teammates. And the people he was trying to praise were the people who had sat on the subs bench and were outside, you know, warming down basically after the game. Mm. And they were coming back in, and every time they came back in, he'd stop the interview to go and say well done to Morgan Gibbs-White, or well done to Matt Doherty, got on for 5 minutes. And it just seemed such a happy camp, and I think that's so much to do with the manager.
Well, you do like him, don't you?
His name means Nuno Holy Spirit.
Oh really? I didn't know that. Okay. Right, let's just wrap up with, I want to just have a very brief chat about Petr Cech, who announced last week he'd be retiring from the game. I'm going to bring in a host of Blue Lions TV, Nene. I've got your name wrong last time. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing very well, and thank you for getting my name right.
The whole pod last time I was calling you Nine Nine, and afterwards I was like, what an idiot. You absolute idiot.
Right.
Apologies for that, my friend. You well? You good?
Yeah, I'm good. I actually came back from Tenerife literally late last night. So, yeah, it's been a very busy January so far, but yeah, everything's going fine. Everything's going to plan.
Good man. So Petr Cech is at my club, but I think most people would associate him more so with your club. He'll be retiring at the end of the season. Tell me a little bit about why you think he was so successful as he was, and whether you think he gets the rightful acclaim that I think Terry, Lampard and Drogba get for that kind of spine of that team.
Yeah, I think Petr Cech really doesn't get as much acclaim as he deserves. I think in that Champions League run where we obviously beat Bayern Munich to win it, that was probably the best goalkeeping performance I've ever seen. I mean, again, in the final, for example, the penalty shootout, he dived correctly every single time for the Bayern penalties. It was no surprise that he made those saves. And his performances against Barcelona, I mean, he was actually the main reason why they actually stayed in the tie. You know, the first leg where, you know, they hit the post how many times. He produced fantastic saves against Messi too in the second leg with the penalty. Without Petr Cech in goal, it's impossible that we would have won the Champions League. And it's no surprise why Drogba consistently praises Petr Cech every single time. Because he knows. I mean, Drogba was the one that made the mistake in the final to give that penalty to Robin. If it wasn't for Petr Cech to save that. You know, he saved penalties against Messi and Robin, and his overall game, you know, he could pass the ball, he could start the counter-attacks. He was a leader in the at the back as well. Fantastic shot-stopping. And his overall game was very, you know, developed. And you look at some of the modern goalkeepers today, you know, they've become a lot more specialised now. I think with Petr Cech, he's one of like the, not going to say old school ones, but I would say that he was part of like the older pros that were very accomplished in all aspects of their game.
I think a lot of people actually forget that as well as the shootout and doing well in that shootout in that Champions League final, he did save a penalty in the 90 minutes, which would turn out to be a very, very important one as well. One of the things that I love about Petr Cech, not so much in the last couple of years, because he's obviously been on the decline slightly, as does happen with age, is that I was always impressed that for someone so big, he always got down really, really quickly.
Yeah.
You know, Joe Hart is a big guy. There's been some tall goalkeepers in the Premier League in the last 5 to 10 years, but I was always impressed that he always got down, really collapsed really well for someone so big. Technically, do you think he was the best goalkeeper of his era?
I would personally say he was, and I can understand why at Arsenal maybe he's been a bit inconsistent. I think one guy that really helped him a lot was his ex-goalkeeping coach, you know, Christophe Olajuwon. Obviously Courtois didn't really get along with him as well. So I heard the training methods are very abstract, so that seemed to get the best out of Petr Cech's game, which isn't a surprise because, you know, the guy is a very intelligent outside of football anyway. So it's not a surprise that he has his own, like, you know, delayed training sessions. Maybe if Fulham left to Arsenal with him, this would have been a different story, but, you know, football's not as convenient as that. I think Petr Cech didn't really get as much praise. I think if he goes to Arsenal, maybe hard to say with money, but if he went abroad when he left us, I'm sure that his name would be very high. But, you know, let's look at the realities of his career. Fantastic moments. I mean, the Champions League run, I keep talking about it every single time, but I haven't seen a goalkeeper do anywhere close to that.
No, it was.
He never got any praise for it.
He was impressive. Josh, do you think that the last few years at Arsenal has slightly stained his legacy, or do you think that what he did at Chelsea, no one will remember the decline in the last 2 years in particular towards the end of his career?
I think he'd still be regarded as one of the best goalkeepers to play in the Premier League. I think he was when he was at the height of his game. I don't think he was the best, but he's definitely up there as someone you would regard as one of the best.
What do you think discounts him from being regarded as the best of his generation?
Because I think the decline happened whilst he was at Chelsea. I don't think it's because he even moved. Mm-hmm. I think his last couple of seasons at Chelsea were not the best.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure why that was. It seemed like he was, you know, coming, I don't know, that there was some change in his game and he was declining, and was obviously Courtois got the number one spot and they moved him on. But I think they moved him on for a reason, because they realised he was a declining goalkeeper. I think that I will say this: when Chelsea were winning league titles under Mourinho, the Petr Cech of that era was probably one of the most annoying goalkeepers who my team's ever played in the Premier League, or I've ever watched. Like, when you're watching Chelsea games, you're willing them to lose, and he just makes amazing save after amazing save. Not only was he a great shot stopper, but he was also had very, very good command of his area, of his 6 yard box. And probably after the only goalkeeper I would say that made me stand up and think, how the hell did he save that in the Premier League? Of this latest kind of era, apart from De Gea.
Unbelievable saves.
Yeah. I mean, like, consistently as well. Like the odd game, but consistently making unbelievable saves. And I can think of other goalkeepers like Oliver Kahn, who made me think like that. Peter Schmeichel made me think like that as well. But I think that the height of his game wasn't a very prolonged period, in my opinion. I think that Piatek was like at his most elite level 3 years.
Okay.
And I feel like he kind of declined after that.
Jack, we all know about the injury, the incident he had, where he had, brain concussion.
Yes.
Which led to him obviously wearing the cap subsequently. How brave do you think it was that he came back into football, albeit wearing the cap, after having something like that happen to him? Because obviously, as a goalkeeper, you know, you're catching balls, there's elbows flying everywhere. Do you give him a lot of credit for coming back and maintaining, even if Josh is true, what Josh is saying is true, for 2 or 3 years after that at the top level?
Yeah.
How brave was that decision?
It's an incredibly brave decision. I think it's the measure of the man. If we're, you know, being frank about it, he's always come across as a true professional. He's always come across as a genuinely lovely human being. I remember on a similar kind of vein, when I've forgotten his name.
Goalkeeper?
Spurs.
Goalkeeper?
No, centre midfielder.
Mason.
Ryan Mason.
Oh, yes.
Had the head injury. The first person to call his family and speak to him, they always said, was Petr Cech, who came in, sat with him in the hospital, and made sure that basically he talked to him, was like, it's going to be all right. You know, I've suffered similar. I know what it feels like. I'll help you. And all of that, I kind of think, is just the measure of a human being as well as a footballer. Not only did he scale the heights of the game, and, you know, he was maybe unlucky to play in a Czech team that was actually the dwindling embers of a great generation before that, with Nedved and Jan Koller and Jan Kolovsky and all of those players. And actually, if he'd played with those players, then that Czech team could have, you know, if that had happened to fall in the right place, then he might have, you know, won a Euros or something. And I think that would have elevated him in a lot of people's eyes to, you know, maybe the kind of top level that maybe some people don't see him on. I've always seen him as an elite goalkeeper, one of the greatest in my lifetime, maybe not the greatest, but definitely on that top table. And I think that on top of that, a wonderful human being, a wonderful ambassador for the game. And I really hope that for either Arsenal or Chelsea's sake, one of them takes him on as a coach and an ambassador and someone to really guide the next generation through, because he comes across as that kind of man.
Nene, my club hopefully will be fighting to keep him on, as Jack says, to work for the club, because we've let too many people out the door, former players and current players as well, but I'm sure your club will be as well. Jack's the only player that we've had at Arsenal in the last few years who we've brought in, and people have had top careers, and I've genuinely felt sorry for him, because I thought to myself, you've been in Champions League finals, you've won multiple Premier Leagues, and you're just getting battered every week at Arsenal. Yeah. I genuinely felt sorry for him, because he didn't deserve what happened to him in the last couple of years. Finally, what do you think he should do now? Do you see him as someone that could offer something on TV? Do you think coaching will be the thing he does? Or, do you think, we've spoken about how intelligent he always comes across, is there something maybe, you know, separate to football and media that you think he could do that makes an impact on the game?
To be honest, I would love to see him, you know, do something like that, because again, you know, he is very intelligent. I think the Arsenal players used to maybe take the mickey a bit by saying that he spoke the most in the dressing room. He was always talking, you know, telling people what to do or whatever. But I think his analysis on the game would be very unique to listen to. I kind of feel that he'll get like an ambassador role at Chelsea, and I think that's how his career is.
No. You're not having him back.
I see it going like that, though. I just think, I think that, that's what he's probably preparing for now, the next stage of his career.
I think there's definitely a gap in the market, I think, on TV for a goalkeeper analysis, a goalkeeper that analyses games. I know a lot of people want to hear that, but
we need more like Liam Rosenmeers on TV. I think Petr Cech could be another one if he was on TV. You know, guys like Garth Crooks and guys like that.
Just listen, Nene, thanks for your time, man. Cheers for coming on.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Take care, man.
As well. Cheers, guys. Guys, Josh, Jack, cheers for coming on.
Thank you.
See, we avoided Fulham talk. We could talk about Fulham's demise and whether they're going down or not.
We're going to swerve that one out of time.
Do not forget to subscribe to the podcast. We're on all the socials. Also subscribe to us on iTunes and Spotify. Leave us a message, a comment. It makes a difference and we really appreciate it. Tell your friends. Until next week, peace.